Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Pretty well. Can't complain.
Yay.
This is the final episode of our Summer Blast series.
Woohoo. Vacations can be deadly.
Vacations can be deadly. And not only because you want to kill the people, your family that you go with.
Oh, but, amen.
You know, other reasons too.
Just be careful. Be careful out there.
Yeah, be careful what you're doing.
Exactly.
Are you ready to just dive right in?
Let's dive right in.
Get
her done.
Get her done. All right. Well, this little tale takes us to Bermuda.
Bermuda.
Okay. I've never been
triangle?
To Bermuda. No. I've never been to Bermuda. Have you?
No.
Okay. Me neither. Bermuda is England's oldest surviving colony. It has beautiful pink sandy beaches and really brightly colored houses dotting the shoreline. It's very gorgeous, and it welcomes vacationers from all over the world. So when 16-year-old Becky Middleton hears about how gorgeous this dreamlike paradise destination is, she knows where she is going for her summer vacation.
Bermuda!
Middleton and her best friend, Jasmine Means, have decided that they're going to spend the summer there after school was out in June 1996. They wouldn't be alone on the island, as Jasmine's dad was now living there after getting remarried.
Mm.
His job took him down there. Now, this is a true wish for any teen girl.
No doubt.
Well, any girl, actually. It was only 2 weeks later when Becky and Jasmine decide to get all dolled up and go out for an evening. They would soon end up at a local watering hole called the White Horse Pub.
Hmm.
They had agreed to meet some boys that they had met earlier, and they decided to all meet up at that location. After hanging out for a little while, the girls decided to go to one of the boys named Jonathan's home. Now, he lived not very far away from the bar. As the party was kicking off, the girls, along with some of the boys, enjoyed a few drinks and some teen shenanigans. Now, remind you, they're only 16-ish.
16, so I'm assuming the drinking age is...
Not 16.
Not 16?
Correct. Mm-hmm. So it was after 1 a.m. when Jasmine's dad realized that he had not heard from Jasmine, who was supposed to have called him by that time. At this point, after having a few drinks, Jasmine knew that her dad would be upset. So she didn't return the call. She didn't call it back.
Yeah, but it's better to call, right?
It is better
it is.
To call. Becky
Silly
and Jasmine
girl.
Decide to call a taxi cab, catch a ride home. The girls go outside to wait for the cab, and after several minutes, the cab never shows up. The two girls go back inside to call the cab company once again. The cab company states that they had sent a cab and that the cab had driven over there and didn't see anybody, so they took off. They said that they would send another cab. The girls go back outside and wait for the cab. Now, at this point, it's getting extremely late and, you know, they are in a foreign country. As they're waiting, a gentleman comes by on a motorcycle. His name is Dean, and they know Dean. Dean pulled over and asked them what they were doing out because it was so late, and they told him they were waiting for a cab. Now, as they were talking, and like I said, they knew Dean, so they felt comfortable with Dean, another motorcycle pulls up, and on it, there are two men. Now, they kind of know Dean, and Dean kind of knows them as well.
Mm.
Not close friends or anything like that, but are familiar with each other. They know each other's name. Since it's getting so late, all the guys offered to give the two girls a ride home. Now, Jasmine hopped on the back of Dean's bike, while Becky gets on the other bike with the two boys. Becky was a little bit smaller in size than Jasmine, so she went ahead and got on the bike with the two boys.
No.
Stranger danger, girls. Come on.
Stranger
danger. As they are traveling home, the two girls lose sight of each other. Jasmine is with Dean on the bike, and Becky is in front of them. Now, somehow, Jasmine loses sight of Becky altogether. So Jasmine arrives home safely, and she beats Becky there, who was not there yet.
Now, she was with the two men.
She was with the two men.
Yeah, that's not
so good. Jasmine sits up for a little bit and waits and waits and waits. Jasmine and Dean continue to wait outside to see if Becky will be arriving home.
And Becky's tiny.
As time passes, Jasmine begins to panic. So she decides to go inside the house and wake up her dad.
Good girl.
It is July 3rd, 1996. Rick Means, who is Jasmine's dad, is angry, and he demands to know where his daughter had last seen Becky. Jasmine tells him she last saw her on the bridge. There was a nearby bridge that they had to cross in order to get to their house. The pair head out to look for Becky. Jasmine, who fears that she's going to get in trouble with her dad, fails to tell him that Becky hopped on a motorcycle with two strangers.
Oh, teenagers are so silly.
Nearby, on Ferry Road, club DJ Dana Rowlings is driving home from a gig with some friends in the car. He sees something peculiar laying in the road. Now, Rollins at first thought it was a dog, but he stops the car, leaving on his headlights to be able to see it better. As he gets closer, he could see it was a female who was bent over into the fetal position.
Mm.
There was blood, but she was still alive. He screamed out to his friends back in the car to contact police.
Good for him. No, I just...
It was normal.
So silly.
So Rollins tried to comfort her, but she was unable to speak. He noticed her throat was cut.
Oh.
Although she was trying to tell him something, she could not speak. He told her not to talk and promised her she was going to be okay and he was going to stay with her and just to hang in there. Jasmine and her dad are back near the location where Jasmine had last seen Becky. They're searching desperately for her. And as they're driving in that area, an ambulance passes them. And in Jasmine's heart, she knew, and she even said out loud, "That's for her."
Oh my gosh. Could you imagine?
Sadly, before the ambulance arrived, Becky quit breathing and her pulse stopped. Rawlings was still comforting her as she passed. Jasmine and her dad finally return home after searching for 2 hours and not being able to locate Becky. Rick calls the authorities to file a missing person report. The police tell Rick that they cannot take a missing person report at this time because they don't file them until 24 hours after the person had been missing. As Rick is arguing with them that she is a young girl and in no way would disappear on her own, he is put on hold.
Oh, that's frustrating.
A police officer returns to the phone and demands that Rick go to the Ferry Reach. Now, that's a location down there. Rick is demanding to know if they found Becky, and the police officer will not tell him anything, but only that he needs to report to the Ferry Reach immediately. As Rick arrives, he is met with the crime scene. He demands his daughter stay in the car, who is now crying uncontrollably. He hopped out of the car, runs to the scene, and demands to know what's going on. Police ask if he is the one that filed the missing persons report, and he says yes, indeed, it was him. An officer bends down and slowly unzips the body bag, and inside is a young girl. Officers ask Rick to identify her, and he does. It is Rebecca Middleton.
Poor baby.
That horrible phone call that Rick Means would have to make to her parents and inform them their baby had been murdered would have to be excruciating.
I could not even, I couldn't even imagine.
That's the part I just kept thinking, how could you do that in a foreign country well, that's, and call them?
I can't let my kids go away on vacation with anybody else just for that reason.
My daughter's about to leave for 2 weeks to go to Seattle.
But so she's with your mom. Yeah, that's different. You trust your mom. You trust your sister.
So Jasmine is in shock as the detectives come to the house to question her. All she could really remember or say was that Becky had gotten on the motorcycle with two black males that she did not know. And that was the first time that her father, Rick, had heard that information. Could you imagine the shock on that?
Oh, were they from Aruba, do you know? Or will we find that out later?
I don't
later?
Know if they're from Aruba because we're talking about Bermuda.
That's what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Were they from Bermuda?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Local citizens. At the crime scene, officers soon locate Becky's bloodied clothes. They find a bra that was cut off her, as well as her pants that were sliced down the front. Many of the officers on scene are not experienced with this type of crime or investigation, which means they don't use the correct procedure when collecting the evidence.
Right.
That's going to be important later.
Well, collecting the evidence properly is always important later.
The shocking news soon hits all over the island. Now, the island was not used to having this kind of crime. And the island, which had been known for tourism, obviously that's going to have a major impact on tourism and having tourists come there. But to have the death of a beautiful, blonde American girl is something that they were not prepared for. They were not prepared for all the media sensation and, you know,
right. Everything
that would come with that. July 3rd, 1996. The autopsy is now beginning on Becky's body. Officials are in a hurry to get the autopsy results back in because they want it to kind of be shoved under the carpet,
right. If
you will.
Mm-hmm.
They want it done quickly. And when things are done quickly, and Jen, you and I know about this.
No.
Mistakes are made. The autopsy results had come back in, and it had revealed that Becky Middleton had been brutally raped, tortured, stabbed, and her throat was cut.
Just a baby.
She had 16 stabbings, with 5 going into vital organs. The jugular vein was cut, along with 19 superficial wounds, mostly on the neck and head area. It was determined that these superficial wounds was caused by somebody dragging a serrated knife across her skin. Now, this is something I did not know. This actually has a name. It is a torture. I guess it's a type of torture that's called the Jamaican torture or Jamaican torture technique.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does basically is it's used to get somebody to comply. So it's painful and it's leaving marks. And when they uncooperate, you get a serrated knife. So she had several like dots running across her forehead and neck. Now, as a pretty little girl too, that would be, you know,
serrated like a bread knife.
Yes.
And then they put pressure on it and then just rock it back and forth. Oh,
yes.
Lord.
Terrible. I mean, and you would comply. And that's the whole, it's not really meant to kill you. It's meant to get you to comply.
That would hurt.
Police are now desperate to find a killer. And so they now look to Dean Lattimore. Now, Dean was the young man that was on the other motorcycle that had given Jasmine a ride home.
Now, is he a local or a tourist?
He's a local too.
Okay.
Dean Lattimore is called in for a lineup. And they make no mistake and do something different, which is that they don't put him behind glass. So he has to actually stand in front of several men.
Ooh.
And say which one or which two were the perpetrator, but right in front of them.
That doesn't work.
Okay, and this is a small island.
Right.
You got to think of how that's going to go.
Repercussions and, yeah, that was
so
silly.
Dean takes a look at them, all of the men standing in front of him, and he thinks about how this will be to have to see these men again and the men's relatives. He recognizes one of the men that Becky got a ride with, but he tells police at that moment that none of the men were the perpetrator, claiming that he didn't know any of them because they were wearing helmets. Now, they were wearing helmets, but they did acknowledge each other that night.
Right.
So they knew each other.
Right.
At the least.
That's why Becky felt safe.
Correct.
Going on the bike with them. Lord.
July 9th, 6 days after Becky's murder, there's a break in the case. Dean Lattimore has a change of heart, and he realizes he needs to do the right thing.
Good.
Those killers are out there, and he knows that they may do it again. He comes forward, and he identifies the two men who gave Becky a ride that night as 21-year-old Kirk Mundy and 19-year-old Justice Smith.
Hmm.
So with this, they now have some information, but that's not all.
They have names. That's good.
They have names to go with the men on the bike. But that's not all. Another witness steps forward, and he says he saw the two men near the crime scene that very evening. Apparently, the man's car had broken down on that bridge, and as he was waiting for help, Mundy and Smith pulled up and chatted with him, and he knew them. The witness also stated that he noticed that there was blood on Mundy's shirt. Smith and Mundy are arrested the very next day. Mundy was actually out on bail for armed robbery, so obviously he's a nice guy.
He's a very nice guy.
It seems that Mundy was more of the leader. Now, he was the older one, and Smith kind of followed along with whatever he said. Smith had dropped out of school, and he had also had a few run-ins with police. So the two, when they get pulled in, of course, they say they have no idea what police are talking about, and that Dean Lattimore must have got it wrong. Smith states that the two were at a nightclub that evening during the time of the murder. But I guess Smith never checked in with Mundy, who gave a very different story. Mundy states that he had nothing to do with it because he was at home with his pregnant girlfriend. So there's mistake number one.
Right.
They both say they were together, but each doing something different, right?
Right. So they're lying?
They are lying.
So they're dumb liars.
They're dumb liars. Just wait, this is terrible. So police take samples from both of the men, hoping to compare it with what they've collected from Becky. Now, those samples are sent off to be examined. Another man comes forward as a witness. He states that he saw the two guys on the motorcycle around 3:20 a.m. Now, that would contradict both of their lying stories they just gave. The man noted something strange which made him pay attention, and it was that there was a white piece of cloth covering the motorcycle license plate.
Huh.
Becky wore a white t-shirt that evening, and it was missing from the crime scene.
So they just put it on the bike?
They put it to cover the license plate.
Oh.
It was covering the license plate. In Bermuda, murder is a hangable offense. Mundy, such a nice guy, starts to panic, and he asks for a lawyer.
They all do.
The lawyer informs him that if that DNA sample comes back and, in fact, connects him to the crime, he will be going down for the murder of Becky Middleton.
Actually, he will be going...
And well.
He'll be swinging in the breeze.
That's enough to start scaring him to sing. He starts singing like a canary. And the canary story is way different than what we've heard so far. Mundy, who had previously said he had nothing to do with this because he was at home with his pregnant girlfriend, now says that Becky, who's 16, was coming on to him.
Oh, of course she was.
He then
goes
attractive.
On. Attractive.
Mm-hmm. He then goes on to say that they stopped the motorcycle so that the two of them could have consensual sex.
Mm-hmm. I believe him, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. He continues to say that Smith was the one who murdered Becky and that it was all Smith and he had absolutely nothing to do with it. Mundy claims he went to go wash his hands in the restroom and when he came back, he saw Smith was raping and stabbing Becky. But not only that, he knows exactly where the murder weapon is. It would be a little bit difficult to find that knife, as he claims Smith tossed it over the bridge into the water.
Well, he's the leader, right? So the follower stooge Smith is going to get the brunt of it.
It's days after the murder, and police are still not quite sure as to what happened. The attorney general's office steps in, and it makes a deal with Kurt Mundy. He is charged with being an accomplice. In exchange for this, Mundy will testify against Justice Smith. All of this was done, mind you, before the DNA evidence had come back. Mundy pleads guilty to being an accessory, and he gets 5 years. It's now October 18th, 1996. Only 2 days after his sentencing, the DNA results arrive.
Now, why didn't they just wait?
Do you want to take a guess as to
it was the
who
other
was
way
positive
around.
With the DNA?
It was totally flipped.
Here's a hint. It rhymes with Pert Fundy.
Mm-hmm. No, it was totally flipped.
At this point, authorities want to charge him with murder, but they can't because he's already made a plea deal. The double jeopardy rule is now in play, and it prevented any further action in this case. There is, however, one option left, and that is to get a murder conviction on Justice Smith. The strongest evidence they have is that knife that was tossed over the bridge. They bring an American forensic pathologist in to examine it all, and his name is... Dr. Michael Baden. We all know him.
Yeah, he's on every TV show ever.
Correct. Just like fingerprints, knives and knife serrations have a different pattern. Mm-hmm. It's a very certain pattern. When the knife that is collected was compared to the serration marks on Betty, they matched perfectly. There was no doubt that this knife was, in fact, the murder weapon. The knife that they found was tossed over, was identified as coming from the Smith household. The Smiths had a knife block on the kitchen counter with one knife missing. This is the other thing that kills me about these.
How'd they find the knife?
It was in the water. They went and dove and
got it. They had divers.
But here's the thing. If you have a knife block and you're going to use, you know, your mom's knife block because you're only 19 years old and you're going to steal that knife and you're going to leave that one empty spot in that knife block, right? You think that's a good idea? I'm going to say no.
I don't think they planned to do it. Probably just took it for the heck of it. I mean, not that they were going to have a picnic and they needed to cut up some French bread or anything, but...
You never know, dude.
I guess. They could be the romantic type, but I doubt it.
So now authorities go back and they take a look at how badly this autopsy was botched. Dr. Baden says that several mistakes were made. For example, the body of Becky was washed before the examination was complete. They washed her body before examining her. Are you kidding me? Now, we know that's a big no-no. No fingernail scrapings were taken from under her nails. If they had, they would have been able to tell if one or both of the defendant's DNA was under her nails, right? Leading you to believe she fought off one or fought off both, which is important. Based on the examination, Dr. Baden believes that two men killed her, not just one. Baden believes that Becky was shocked when they pulled the motorcycle over. One, if not both, get off and rape her as she is screaming, crying, and tries to crawl away. And that's when they yank her back in. Bain believes that she had to have been held forcibly down by one of the attackers as the other one was attacking her face with the serrated edge of the knife because the wounds were too neat. So indicating that somebody was holding her head because the knife wasn't, it was perfect little dots, right?
They kept her head still while somebody else
There were
the
also
torture.
No defensive wounds on her hands, indicating that she was being held down. He believes that possibly she sat up and was then stabbed in the neck, which sliced her jugular vein. That combined with the punctured lung, she was unable to get up and walk. Marks on her upper arms and ankles indicate she was picked up. She was carried to the road in an attempt to have someone find her and possibly help her or save her. They knew she would not survive long if they did not do that.
Well, if you've got the jugular, she's not going to survive long anyway. I'm surprised she survived as long as she did.
After hearing all this information, the prosecution closes its case. The defense doesn't call a single witness. Smith's lawyer simply asked for the case to be dismissed due to circumstantial evidence. The judge, after looking at all the evidence, assumes it's an open and shut case, and that he, Justice Smith, will be found guilty, but what happens next, no one is prepared for. The case never makes it to the jury. The lead prosecutor on the case left the island a week before Smith's trial, leaving it to a newcomer to take up the case. After days of evidence, the judge directed the jury to acquit Smith, saying there was not enough evidence against him. And with that announcement, Smith simply walks out of the courthouse. For the next 14 months, a series of appeals followed, but due to the double jeopardy law, the decision could not be reversed. Bermuda and Canada are left stunned. She was from Canada.
Okay.
Coming as no surprise, it was only 2 years later, but Justin Smith would stab a woman outside a bar. Smith would spend only 1 year in prison for that stabbing. Sadly, in the end, no one would end up answering for the brutal rape and murder of Rebecca Middleton. In a bittersweet postscript, Dana Rawlings, the DJ that had found her in the road, named his daughter after Rebecca. Half the people in the jury were left crying. They just couldn't believe it. Now, what followed were a series of futile attempts to retry Justice Smith, but they were ultimately rejected by Britain's Privy Council on the grounds he had already stood trial once, their version of double jeopardy. In 2007, internationally renowned human rights lawyer Cherry Booth, wife of former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, argued Smith's murder charge was wrongly dismissed and that Mundy should have faced a more serious charge. That didn't happen. Ultimately, 10 years after the murder, Bermuda compensated the Middleton family for pain and suffering. You ready?
Free vacation.
The check was for $2,800.63.
Wow.
$2,800.
Did the family sue the other family?
No. I think they just, I mean, it's just too painful. It was terrible. So that's the case. It's just shocking in the sense that, well, it's a lot shocking in lots of the senses, but that guy, I hate to say it, was smart. He's sneaky bastard smart that he thought, hey, I'm going to get this plea deal before that DNA and I'm going to have to do 4 years, but that's better than dying.
Hanging from it. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to Bermuda now. Not that I ever really thought about doing it anyway. That is awful. I can't believe all the screw-ups that they've done. I mean, waited. They didn't wait until the DNA comes back. Come on.
I think part of it.
I'd think about that first.
I think part of it was the tourism. To see somebody brutally murdered in this fashion, they just want it done. They want the person punished. That's their number one business down there is tourism. So
of
if
course.
That suffers, you know, they all suffer. Yeah. Anyway, that's all I got.
Gross.
I'm gonna tell the good people where they can find us.
You can find us at Our True Crime Pod on Twitter. We have a blog that we need to keep updated, www.ourtruecrimepodcast.com. We have an Instagram, which is what our Instagram is. Camille, do you remember?
Our True Crime Podcast.
Our True Crime Podcast on Instagram. And we have a Gmail, ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. And I think that's about it. Please, please, if you will, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, or Apple Podcasts. You don't even have to write anything. Just leave that 5 stars. If you're going to leave 1 star, don't even bother.
Just move on down the dial, people.
Move it on.
Nobody has time for that.
Yeah.
All right. So remember, luck. your doors.
We keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. Don't talk to strangers, baby, don't you go.
Were they from
Bermuda?
The boys? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Local citizens.
I should know that because there was just on that documentary Now, they were talking about Bermuda. They were selling globes. And it's like, I don't want this globe. This says Bermuda. And they're like, well, that's how the locals pronounce it, Bermuda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mercilessly. And stabbed.
Say
mercifully.
Hanged. That's right. Hanged. It's drug, but it's hanged.
It's dragged, too, but it's not with us, anyway.
It's whatever we want it to be, because it's our podcast.
All right, buddy.
Screw grammar.
God dang it. Hold on. Dang it. Okay, sorry. So in Bermuda, murder. In Bermuda, murder with the hang about a plant. Sorry. So Monday.
Solomon Monday, born on Monday.
So good to be here. Okay, sorry.
Rainy days and Monday always brings me down.